From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in this week for Evan Dawson, and this hour we are talking about strokes. They are the leading cause of disability in the United States, one of the leading causes of death. We tend to think of them as something that primarily affects older Americans, but it can affect anybody, including younger people. We'll be talking about that and much more this hour, and taking your phone calls and questions as well. You can join us on the phone at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And we are on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. Looking forward to hearing from you over the course of this hour as we talk with Dr. Mary Dombovi of Rochester Regional Health. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Happy to have you with us. Let's start with the basics here. What is a stroke?
So think of a stroke as a brain attack. When you have a problem with blood flow to your heart, we call it a heart attack. So a stroke is a problem with blood flow to your brain. There's three basic types of stroke. The most common one, 75 to 80% of strokes, are caused when something clots off or blocks the blood supply to a part of the brain, and then the brain tissue in that area dies. The other two types of strokes are types of strokes where blood vessels will break, and they can cause either bleeding in the brain, and we call that an intracerebral hemorrhage, or around the brain, we call that a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Many of those are due to a disease of the blood vessel called an aneurysm, where a balloon kind of grows on the blood vessel and then breaks.
With any of these, rapid responses is the most important thing to helping to prevent permanent damage or death, right?
It is definitely critical. For the type of stroke where you have a blockage in an artery and not enough blood and oxygen is getting to your brain, to be eligible for the clot-busting drug called TPA, think of it as Drano. You know, put Drano in your drain and it dissolves what's ever clogging your drain. The idea behind this is it dissolves the clot. We have to give that drug within 3 to 4 hours of the time your stroke starts, or we can't give it, because if we give it too late, the risk of complications is high.
How do you know if I'm sitting at home? What symptoms am I going to feel if I'm experiencing a stroke? How do I know that I'm having one?
Well, we have a simple message that many of the people who work with stroke have done in concert with the American Stroke Association, and there's an acronym for it called FAST. And that stands for Face, Arm, Speech, and Time. So drooping face, weak arm, trouble talking. Time means call 911, don't call your neighbor, don't call your doctor, get the ambulance there, and do it fast.
Don't try to drive yourself to the hospital.
Do not try to drive yourself to the hospital. I mean, unfortunately, even with strokes that don't cause paralysis, they can cause serious impairments in your vision, in your judgment or thinking, and you may not be aware that you have those. You're really at risk if you would drive yourself.
Are there any statistics of the number of people who don't realize that this is what they're having, and if they had just reacted quicker, could have been saved and end up not being able to be?
Well, about half of all people don't know what a stroke is, and even more don't understand what symptoms constitute a stroke and that they should get to the hospital. One of the things that we're trying to work on is getting more people to the hospital on time. Right now, no matter what hospital, less than 30% of our patients are getting there on time to be eligible for the new treatments.
And if you don't get there in time to be eligible for these treatments, what are the other options at that point? What happens to you?
Well, after a stroke, there are a lot of other problems that can develop. You can develop problems with your breathing, with pneumonia, with your heart, with blood clots in your legs. You may not be able to swallow. So you still will need the benefit of excellence in medical care and at a place where people understand stroke and are experts in that area, not just the physicians, but the nurses, the therapists, the entire team that's caring for a stroke patient.
Talk to me about what you have here and what resources we have available in Rochester, at Rochester Regional Health, the former Unity, and Rochester General, the merged system there. and across town as well. What resources do we have here? Where do we rank nationally in terms of being able to deal with these issues?
All of the hospitals in the Rochester area are certified stroke centers. And to be a certified stroke center, you have to meet certain standards of care. You have to meet the time standards, but you also have to show that you're doing the assessments, providing the appropriate treatment to patients after a stroke. So the main message I would say to people is get to the closest primary stroke center and get there as fast as you can. There are new and emerging treatments for stroke that consist of using a catheter where you go into a blood vessel in the groin, and you put that catheter and you snare the clot out. This is the Roto-Rooter approach. Hmm. Not that they look like that, but think of it as they're...
So we've got Drano, we've got Roto-Rooter.
Right. So we're cleaning that artery out in some fashion. Those are provided at selected areas. The problem is that only less than 10% of all stroke patients at this time are really eligible. I think with more research and the development of better catheters, better approaches, that number will expand some to perhaps 15, maybe 20% at most over the next 5 to 10 years. So the main thing is you need to get to a place where they know how to care for stroke. The time window to use these Roto-Rooter catheters and pull the clots out is longer. So even if they don't have it at the hospital that you're at, there's plenty of time in the Rochester area, and we work together on this to get to a place where that's available.
What are, you mentioned that only certain patients are eligible. What are the factors that determine that?
If a patient has had, let's say, recent surgery, has had a stroke within the last few weeks, has an ulcer in their stomach that's bled, some other conditions, if a patient is already on a blood thinner, that's a high-powered blood thinner, because this is a substance that, I'm going to use the word, thins your blood, any of those things would put you at high risk for bleeding if we gave the TPA, the clot-busting medication.
We are talking with Dr. Mary Dombovi from Rochester Regional Health, and we're talking about strokes this hour. Your input is very welcome, this conversation, too. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 is our toll-free phone number. You can call us locally here in Rochester, 263-9994, and on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. We want to hear your questions and your stories, too. Perhaps you've suffered a stroke, perhaps you know somebody who has, and you've watched the recovery process. Set this up sort of historically with some of these treatments. If this had happened, you know, if you'd had a stroke, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago, how much less likely is it that you'd have survived and been able to get on with your life than it is now?
Well, currently, about 20 to 25% of patients with stroke, depending on the type of stroke, will pass away related to the stroke within the next few weeks. For the main type of stroke, the death rate is really only around 17%. So if you go back about 20 years ago, it was closer to 30%. It's better because we have better treatment, not only direct treatment with the clot-busting drugs, but better treatment of the complications. And we also have better techniques and approaches to work with people who do have, for example, trouble with their speech or weakness. Better rehabilitation therapies have emerged in that time frame.
Let's talk a little bit about what happens afterwards. If you're not one of those 17% of people who don't survive, the outcomes are still, you know, everywhere from total recovery, you get on with your life, to being pretty severely disabled. What determines how you end up? Is it a question primarily of how long you wait for treatment? What are some of the other factors that go into that?
Well, certainly how long you wait is important, but the size of the stroke, the severity of, let's say, how weak your arm or leg is, how impaired your thinking is. If you need rehabilitation, but your memory is poor, or you can't cooperate with the therapy for some reason, you know, that's going to make it more difficult. In the first days after a stroke, we're concentrating on a couple of things. First of all, we're trying to figure out what caused your stroke. What can we do to help you prevent another stroke? We're focusing on preventing complications like blood clots in your legs that might go to your lung, pneumonia, skin breakdown issues if you can't move. And then at the same time, we're also getting therapists, physical therapists, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and a rehabilitation physician to assess you and help decide what kind of rehabilitation do you need. Do you need to go to an inpatient setting where it's 3 to 4 hours a day, very intense? You need the physicians are there to help with medical issues, intensive nursing. Are you doing well enough you could go home with your family? Maybe your arm is slightly weak, you have a little bit of trouble talking, but you still need some therapy. One thing we've learned over the past 10 years is that people who do nothing don't get a lot better. And if you are going to regain walking or the use of your arm, you have to work at it, and you have to work at it repetitively. I'll give you an example. If you wanted to become a professional golfer, you wouldn't practice a half an hour a day, 3 days a week.
Right.
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 So when you learn a new task or a skill, your brain changes. And the same thing can happen after a stroke. But if you want to regain a particular skill, you have to practice that skill. And you can't just do it once a day, 3 days a week.
And a lot of that, of course, is the brain's amazing ability to repurpose parts of itself. How damaged is too far damaged? I mean, if you've lost significant amounts of blood flow to the brain during a stroke, at what point do you say these are just skills that you're never going to be able to have again? And at what point does the brain allow you to say, well, you know, the left hemisphere did this, maybe now the right hemisphere can do this?
It's actually different for every person. And, you know, all of us who have seen a lot of patients with stroke can look and say, gee, those two people look the same after their stroke. The damage to the brain looked the same, but here this person is back home and independent, and the other person is struggling. So some of that is how our brains are wired. Each of us have our brains wired a little differently. Some of it is how hard we work. Some of it is the other medical problems that we have. You know, if you also have heart disease or kidney disease or you've got severe arthritis and are having trouble moving around to begin with, that's going to impact your recovery too. What we like to do is work with patients for a week to 10 days. So we're kind of getting to that point where we're 10 days to 2 weeks after the stroke. Then we generally have a better idea of how well that person is going to do.
I imagine family factors play into that. If you're able to go home and have family support, that's got to make a difference compared to somebody who's on their own and doesn't necessarily have that, right?
Oh, that's a big factor. Yeah. And because you're a guy, you're lucky.
How so?
Well, guys are more likely to go home, especially if they have a wife or a significant other that's willing to take care of them. Unfortunately, if you're a woman, the reverse isn't quite as true for a couple reasons. Socially, men don't necessarily learn those caregiving skills as they're growing up, and so it's a little harder. Not to say that there aren't husbands who, you know, don't take their family member home, but a few less. And women tend to be older when they have their stroke, and a lot of times their spouse is no longer with them or able to provide that care.
Let's talk about some of those age factors. As I said at the top of the show, we tend to think of this as being primarily something that affects older people, but the National Stroke Association says it's one of the 10 leading causes of death among children in the country, affecting 6 of every 100,000 children. There was just a study out of Britain. The number of people in their 40s and 50s in Britain, they found, is on a significant increase just within this century. What are you seeing locally? Do the numbers locally reflect that?
Well, we do see children and young adults with stroke. The causes of their stroke tend to be different than the common causes we see in older people. So in children and young adults, we're often seeing children that have some problem with their heart. that could cause a clot that would go to the brain, something wrong with the actual blood vessels themselves, or some type of problem with blood clotting that, you know, could happen. Stroke can also happen in women with migraines, particularly if they have a migraine that has what we call an aura, meaning some visual or speech or other neurologic symptoms. They're at higher risk for stroke. During the time of pregnancy and immediately after delivery, there tends to be a higher incidence of certain types of stroke in women as well. It still is, though, predominantly an issue for older people. And by far and away, the single most important risk factor for stroke is high blood pressure.
What can you do about that? I mean, obviously, there's medication that's available, regular checkups with your doctor. What do you advise people, you know, in their 40s or their 50s to think, gee, I might, you know, want to make sure that this doesn't happen to me and do what I can do to prevent it from becoming an issue later on in life?
So you should be seeing the doctor frequently enough, even when you're in your 20s, or getting, you know, things monitored on an every other year basis, like cholesterol and things like that. But you can get your blood pressure taken at a number of places. And current guidelines say that your blood pressure should be below 140 over 90. If you have diabetes, it should be even lower, 130 over 80. Why? Because diabetes is another high risk factor for stroke. And diabetes is also associated with problems with lipids like cholesterol, which is cholesterol, high cholesterol is a risk factor. Smoking is a risk factor. Take care of that, you can simply stop. Being overweight. And when you're overweight, you're more likely to have diabetes, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. And then there's a certain type of a heart rhythm problem called atrial fibrillation. Some people are not even aware of it when they have it. Some are. As we get older, our risk of having that heart rhythm abnormality increases. And because we're living longer, we're seeing that as a much more common cause of stroke than we did, say, 20 years ago. Now, all of those things can be treated or modified. That takes some effort on each individual person's part and collaboration with your physician.
The study out of Britain that came out last month described this as being in part really a lifestyle issue. They pointed to that issue you mentioned of obesity as being a very significant risk factor. Are you seeing the same kind of uptick that they're seeing of people in their 40s and 50s who are coming in with these related issues of high blood pressure and cholesterol, obesity, smoking? Is that
most people who we see with strokes in that age range have either diabetes, uncontrolled blood pressure, they're smokers or some combination thereof, or they have some other rare clotting disorder or a heart problem. But the other thing that impacts younger people who have stroke is family history. So you can't change that. Can't change your parents. But that doesn't mean that you can't modify these other things. And there's certainly some evidence to suggest that the generation that's now coming into early adulthood may not live as long as those of us who are the baby boomers, and largely due to the obesity epidemic.
That's a scary thing. At the same time, the British study also noted that because rates of smoking have gone down significantly, that that's actually reduced the overall stroke rate among the entire population as a result. Is that a positive thing on this side of the ocean too?
Yes, the smoking rate has definitely gone down since the 70s, and that is a very positive thing. And keep in mind, smoking can affect your heart, can certainly affect your lungs. It can be related to cancer. So stopping smoking is definitely a must-do.
We are talking with Dr. Mary Dombovi of Rochester Regional Health, and we're talking about stroke on this hour of Connections. We do want to hear from you at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I'm at Scott Feibusch. And we'd love to hear your stories, your questions. If there's something you're wondering about stroke prevention or care, we got the expert here right now. Now is the time to get that question in. You'd mentioned before, I wanted to get back also to the point you made about migraines, which, you know, you're talking about blood pressure and in the head. And you'd mentioned the possibility of auras. Describe that a little bit more. What should people be looking out for if they're prone to migraines, and how quickly should they react if they sense this might be coming on?
Well, some people, as a warning for their migraine, will have some flashing or bright lights or squiggly lines in their vision. They could experience some trouble with their speech. Rarely, but it does occur, some people actually get numbness or weakness on one side of the body before they get a headache. And migraine is actually much more complicated than we used to think it was. And it's related to a disorder of nerve transmission, which can affect blood vessels and whether they're spasming or not, and blood flow in the brain and so on. So people who have migraine with any of these neurologic symptoms, or people who have frequent migraine, meaning they're getting a headache several times a week, that's a migraine, we know are at higher risk for having a stroke. One thing that women who are of childbearing age should not do is, if they have migraine with aura, they should not be taking an oral contraceptive, because the oral contraceptives also slightly bump up your risk of stroke. So if you do both of those things, you're putting yourself at high risk. We certainly recommend that people with migraines seek treatment. There is some preliminary evidence that if we can reduce the frequency of migraines, that we can reduce the risk of stroke. Not certain on that, but that's starting to emerge from some of the people who are being followed and treated.
Is this, I want to understand more about the mechanism of what brings on migraines versus what brings on strokes. It's all related basically to blood pressure within the brain, right?
No, not at all. Blood pressure within the brain is different than blood pressure within the body. So pressure inside the head gets increased when blood can't get out of the head, or that, you know, the flow of the blood getting out of the head is blocked. More commonly, it's increased if you have anything else inside your head. What could that be? It could be a blood clot, a blood vessel ruptured and you have blood inside your head, or it could be a tumor that's growing inside your head. And neither stroke nor migraine are really related to pressure inside your head. Stroke is more related to your blood pressure that you would take in your arm. Why is that? Because high blood pressure causes damage to the walls of the blood vessels and creates an environment where those vessels can be narrowed and clots can form.
Interesting. We are talking to Dr. Mary Dombovi of Rochester Regional Health here on Connections on member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 88.5, and 91.5 HD2 in Rochester, 89.5 in the Finger Lakes, online at WXXI.org, and the WXXI mobile app. We will be back with your calls as well right after this break. Ahead in our second hour of Connections, looking ahead to two signs of summer. What are your kids going to do when school's out? We'll have a panel in the studio talking about affordable summer programs that are still open for signups. And then Rochester's newest festival, the Streetlight Festival, kicks off tomorrow night. We'll find out all about it from its organizers. All just ahead in the next hour of Connections. It's Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson, and we are talking about strokes this hour with Dr. Mary Dombovi of Rochester Regional Health. And with you as well, we hope you'll join our conversation. Please don't wait till the very end of the hour so that we can get your call in. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. We'll be happy to take your questions as well. Dr. Mary Dombovi is here to answer them. One thing I wanted to ask you about, what don't we know right now? What are some of the areas that researchers are looking at that we don't necessarily have answers to right now about causes and about treatments?
Mm-hmm. Treating some types of the bleeding types of stroke have been a little more difficult. Let's say you had a blood vessel rupture and you've got a big clot inside your brain. We're starting to look at ways of treating that without doing surgery and taking it out. In fact, in many cases now, it's becoming apparent that unless that's causing a real high pressure inside your head and it needs to come out, that taking it out may not make you any better. So there's people looking at, can they find ways of dissolving this clot, you know, before? Because a lot of the damage in that type of stroke comes from the pressure on the surrounding brain. So those are areas that we're looking into. Frankly, we understand very little about how the brain recovers. We're beginning to get some insight into that and understanding how the brain might adapt, might change after a stroke, what sorts of medications help or hinder that, what sorts of therapy are the best to make that change in the brain occur that facilitates recovery.
What are some of the tools that you use to analyze that? Is this, are we looking at MRIs? How do you analyze that?
Well, it's very interesting. There's a couple of tools you can use. One of the ones that's used very frequently is something that we call functional MRI. So we have the patient in a scanner and they're doing some type of task. Could be moving a hand, a foot, could be reading something. And at the same time, we're taking MRI pictures that show what parts of the brain are receiving more blood flow than others. And one thing we've noticed after a stroke is that you mentioned the other side of the brain. Actually, the other side of the brain is probably a problem. The other side of the brain tries to help. I'm making this so people can understand. Yeah. But that's probably not helping the recovery process. And there are some new research treatments where they're trying to turn off the other hemisphere to let the damaged hemisphere recover better.
You're not talking about something, you know, so where you're actually severing the connection. You're just temporarily.
But they use magnets. Use magnets to change the, you know, communication between neurons. And one of the other fascinating things is that you can see what area lights up when, let's say, you move your hand, and that changes after a stroke. And then you can see how it changes as a person gets better. So the better a person gets, the smaller the area of the brain that it takes to produce that movement. So in patients who, let's say, still have a lot of trouble using an arm, for example, anytime you ask them to do something, a large area of the brain lights up like it's trying to make this activity happen. If they get almost normal or normal, you see a very small area of the brain light up. It's almost like the brain has become more efficient if it recovers.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. We're talking with Dr. Mary Dombovi from Rochester Regional Health here on Connections. Maria in Rochester, you're on. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Yes, hello. Doctor, I want to tell you about my husband who had his first stroke at age 50. It was pretty massive, but he was able to come through. And one of the after effects that wasn't mentioned is depression. He became aphasic, and his speech was his work. He was a professor. And one of the things regarding the depression was what to do with it. I had no idea. So I convinced two friends, and we did this through a program called the Fresh Air Fund, where we brought children up for New York City, and I made him responsible for the child. He's done this before as a foster parent, and he rose to the occasion. It was amazing. I was working with the help of the two friends. He took care of the child, and after this experience, he finally opened up to the possibility of therapy. He found the program at Nazareth for people with aphasia. He did occupational therapy. He did a little bit of physical therapy, and he came through and went back to work. And that's what I'd like to bring to the listeners.
Well, thank you very much. And first of all, congratulations and kudos to you and your husband. I'm sure you know how much work it takes after a large stroke to get back to that point. So that's a remarkable story. And you do raise a very important point. Depression is actually quite common after stroke. It can affect anywhere from 35 to 45% of patients. There are now research studies that show that if you're depressed, it's going to negatively impact your recovery. So we assess patients for depression after stroke. And if they are depressed, we talk to them about different types of treatment. It could be medical treatment. It could be a combination of that and some type of psychotherapy. Many of the newer antidepressants are effective, and they're also very safe in patients who have had stroke. And there are studies showing that if depressed patients are treated, that they do better. They do better in rehabilitation, and they have better outcomes at the end.
All right. Maria, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good luck to your husband. Is depression after a stroke something that's stroke-specific, or is that, I mean, you hear about it after people have had heart surgery, after people have had other major surgery? How much of it is just that process of being in the hospital and dealing with recovering from anything life-threatening?
It's probably a combination. Keep in mind that your brain not only controls your speech and your arms and legs, but your brain is who you are, and it also controls your behavior, your moods, how you feel. We do know that injury to certain parts of the brain carry a higher incidence or likelihood of having depression afterwards. So the brain itself, injury to the brain itself, can result in depression. Interestingly, after concussion, traumatic brain injury and concussion tend to affect the front parts of our brain, and that's where mood and behavior and so on are. But after concussion, too, depression can be a symptom, not that the person is upset or grieving over having the stroke or the concussion, but it can be actually caused by the change in the brain that's occurred.
Do strokes typically change personality a lot? I'm thinking of some of the people that I've known who've gone through it, and even if they've lost the use of an arm or one side of their face is drooping, it doesn't seem like it really changes the underlying personality that much.
It can if it affects more the frontal parts of the brain. In general, it doesn't change personality as much as a traumatic brain injury will, where that part of the brain is more likely to be damaged, but it certainly can affect personality. Stroke is also associated with another common problem called sleep apnea. And there's been some recent research that shows that the combination of the two is associated with what we call cognitive decline or dementia.
What's the connection there?
Lack of good blood flow to the brain. Now, here's another interesting little tidbit. Another plug for exercising. Exercise may do as much good as or more good than playing mind games in preventing Alzheimer's. And it probably all has to do with how well oxygenated your brain remains as you get older. Not that we know that for sure, but we do know that people who routinely exercise have a lower incidence of stroke, Alzheimer's. People with Parkinson's who exercise often do better, remain more able to walk, get about, do the things that they want.
Interesting. Back to the phones at 844-295-TALK here on Connections. Robin in Rochester, you're next.
Yes, I had a question about if a stroke or heart attack happens, it's not always right after a really traumatic incident or stress-related thing. Sometimes it's a few hours later, and I'd like to know why, and I'd like to take that off air, please.
All right, thanks for the call.
The strokes are not necessarily related to stress. They can occur after a time of stress, but most strokes occur when they occur. They occur more related to things that have accumulated over a period of time. The cumulative effects of blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, if you smoking, on what your blood vessels are like, how narrow they are, and on whether or not a clot would form. So strokes are not necessarily tied directly to a stressful incident.
Thanks for the answer. Let's talk about TIAs. How is a TIA related to a stroke?
A TIA, or a transient ischemic attack, is what we used to refer to as a stroke warning. So it means that in potentially a blood vessel is about to clot off or get plugged up, but there's a little bit of blood flow left. Now we know that some TIAs are actually mini strokes, as our ability to see the brain through MRI has gotten better. In some patients who have a TIA will actually see a stroke. To you, as a person, a TIA should be no different than a stroke, because at the time you don't know if you're going to get better. People with TIAs get better after a few minutes, but you don't know that at the time you're having the symptoms. Same story. Get to the hospital as soon as you can. And in some patients with a TIA, there is something that we need to do right away. If you have this heart rhythm problem, you may need a blood thinner. If you have a major blood vessel that's about to clot off, you may need either endovascular therapy, surgery on that blood vessel, etc. So you need to get to the hospital, because if you don't, in fact, in the weeks immediately after a TIA, your risk of stroke goes way up during that time.
Does it carry with it a lifetime risk? If you have a TIA when you're in your 30s, does it increase your risk of stroke when you're in your 70s or 80s?
No, the biggest risk is in the immediate few weeks after the TIA. And if you have more than one, the risk is even higher for those patients.
Is there a danger, especially with younger people who don't necessarily think, oh, a stroke could happen to me? Does it make people less likely sometimes to respond as quickly as they should because they just don't realize, hey, this is what's happening and I got to deal with this?
I think that's actually a problem no matter what age people are. Now, part of it, keep in mind that as a part of a stroke, you may not know that you're having a stroke because the part of your brain that recognizes what's wrong with you isn't working right. Or you could have a problem with your speech, so you can't make the call. So it's important that people who are living with people who are at risk for stroke understand that too, because in a lot of cases, it's the other person that notices that something wrong and is able to make the call for help.
All right. We continue with phone calls at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Jack in Rochester, you're next on Connections. Hi.
Thank you. My wife has auras. She gets these migraines, but there's no pain. She does not have headaches. But she does have, she says it's like looking through broken glass, and she gets nauseous, and she'll usually lay down for a couple hours. And there is a history of a stroke in her family. Her mother died from a stroke. And but she has no pain with these things. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That actually is something that we know about and we do see. I have several patients who have the aura, may have some of the other symptoms, the I can't concentrate, I can't work on a computer, the nausea, as you mentioned, but don't necessarily get the headache. We refer to that as a migraine variant or a migraine aura without headache. There's evidence that some of the treatments that actually reduce the incidence of the headache may be helpful in reducing the incidence of the aura.
And what do they do? She takes no treatment for this. She is she does have high blood pressure, and she is overweight. And it concerns me when I heard that thing about the migraines and the fact that she has that history of it. Is there something that she can do for these aura attacks that she occasionally gets, like 5-6 times a year or so? It isn't that frequent.
Well, the fact that she only gets them 5-6 times a year is good, because we would consider that to be relatively infrequent. Patients who are getting them on a weekly or a more than once a week basis really should see a neurologist that has some expertise in treating migraines to talk about what their options are.
Okay, very good. Thank you for your help.
All right, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Chris in Rochester, you're next on Connections.
Good afternoon. I have had over my lifetime a substantial number of head injuries. And no one's ever done an MRI. I don't think I've even had an X-ray. But, you know, it's enough to say that, you know, the head has been banged around pretty good. I'm just wondering how that may or may not affect any risk for stroke, heart attack. You know, would there be symptoms that might be more specific to, you know, somebody's had a number of head injuries?
Well, there's certainly evidence that if you have multiple concussions or multiple, even mild head injuries, that your risk for dementia, meaning something like Alzheimer's, is higher and you may get it earlier. But there's really no, with very few exceptions and strange, rare things that could happen, there's no connection with you have having had multiple head injuries, and it doesn't increase your risk of stroke or heart attack.
Okay.
Good to know. All right, then.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We are talking with Dr. Mary Dombovi of Rochester Regional Health. We're talking about strokes for the rest of this hour here on Connections from member-supported public radio. Beverly in Honeoye Falls, you're next on Connections.
Hi. I have had my blood pressure taken, of course, many times, and every time they took it and they put a great deal of pressure on my arm, upper arm, it would ache for several days. I can't believe that this has not caused some damage to my body.
Interesting question.
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that. I mean, it could be that there's something else going on in your upper arm, that when they pump the blood pressure up, they're compressing something that's giving you difficulty afterwards. You know, that's a difficult question to answer. Most of the time, the cuff is up for a very short period of time, and most people would have no after effects from that. So, you know, I would suggest that you work with your regular physician, make him aware that that's happened, and maybe he can take a closer look at your arm.
Could that be a sign of other blood flow problems that could lead to problems with blood getting to the brain?
No, I don't think so. There just might be something with a nerve, or there could be a growth underneath the skin or something that, you know, might be causing a problem.
Interesting. We are talking with Dr. Mary Dombovi from Rochester Regional Health here on Connections. Let's talk a little bit about what happens after with follow-up care, with recovery. We've talked about short-term rehab. What about the long-term for people who are significantly affected by this in a way that really changes their life? What hope is there, you know, if you've been living with the after effects of a stroke for a while? Are there new treatments that can help even with that?
I think right now we're still sort of at the point where we don't understand what we can do that will help people, let's say, who are a year or two after a stroke. There are some people who are actually looking at that, and they're devising treatment programs, maybe using that in concert with some types of medication, looking at recovery, looking at how that functional MRI scan changes. Not clear exactly what the best approach is, but we can say that be as active as you can be. Do what you can. Push the limits. Keep trying to work on those skills. If you can do something partially, or you can do it, let's say, slowly, over time, if you work at it, the chances are that even if it's been a year or more after the stroke, you will get better at it. Immediately after a stroke, it's very important to get proper follow-up care. Most patients, this is a life-changing, a devastating thing in the hospital. They're very confused about what medicines they should take, what they should do. What we've instituted at Rochester Regional is a post-hospital stroke clinic where we offer appointments within a week of discharge to all of our stroke patients. What we've been able to show in the last year and a half that we've been doing that, those patients are much less likely to end up back in the hospital in the next couple of months than patients who don't receive that immediate care. Why? We go over everything with them again. What's a stroke? How can you prevent another one? What do you need to do? What are your medications for? How do you take them? We have a nurse navigator that's available for them to call. We coordinate things with their primary care, so their primary care physician is on the same page with us.
And going on into the longer term, you know, if people have been living with this for 10, 20, 30 years, are there still resources? Is it just a matter of still working on those skills and trying to get back what you've lost?
Well, I think there are also resources in terms of new devices and things that make it easier. There are devices that you can use, you know, to operate the electronics in your home. There are mobility devices that can assist with walking. There are, for example, is a new type of brace for if you have a dropped foot after a stroke that can actually facilitate the foot coming up when you walk so you don't catch your toe or drag your toe. There are also new devices that can assist with grasp in the upper extremity. So there certainly are things emerging that can substitute for things that we can't get back.
What's the funding picture like for that research? Is there, I mean, there's never enough funding for everything that everybody wants to do, but for stroke in particular, what does the funding picture look like right now?
It looks bleaker than it used to. Funding for these types of projects has been difficult. More basic projects, you know, have been more likely to be funded in the past. I think the National Institute of Health, which is, you know, one of the major funders, is taking a different approach now and looking at more collaborative and clinically relevant. The problem is it takes a lot to get that type of funding. And the thing that we're missing is what I call smaller amounts of money that somebody might be able to test a device or test a medication. That type of thing is difficult to get. And if you don't have that start and don't have a little bit of a track record, it's hard to get the bigger funds to do a wider scale study.
Is some of that research happening here in Rochester?
Yes, at Rochester Regional, we're participating in several what are called national or international clinical trials, looking at different types of treatment for stroke. We are going to be having some new, what we call endovascular stroke doctors. They are the ones who do the catheter type things, and they will be bringing with them several large-scale trials that we'll be participating in. We also work collaboratively with the university, looking at a study using functional MRI and recovery from stroke at this time as well.
Is it helping now to be part of this larger Rochester Regional organization?
Oh, yes, it is, because we have so much more expertise available to us. Plus, we're able to see many more stroke patients, and I'm a firm believer that every patient I see is different, and I learn so much from every patient I see and watching them recover and seeing some of the nuances of that. That's what results in ideas for, like, hey, I've got an idea that I could use to help that person.
Are you working primarily out of Unity in Greece, or are you working out of General now as well?
My clinical practice is primarily out of Unity, but I'm responsible for neurosciences throughout the system, so I am spending time at Rochester General and working with the stroke team there as well.
All right. So to recap, for people who are worried about what they can do, especially if you're my age, if you're in your 40s, exercise?
Exercise, make sure you know your numbers, know your cholesterol, know if you have diabetes, know if you have high blood pressure. If you do, work with your primary care physician to get those treated. Lose weight if you're overweight, stay active, don't smoke. And if you do feel that you have some funky, irregular heart rhythm, or you're an older person, there are some people who suggest that all people over 75 should be screened for this atrial fibrillation because it's common. Make sure you get those things done.
Okay.
But also enjoy life.
And if you think you're having any of the symptoms, call 911, get to the hospital.
That's correct. Don't go to bed and take a nap and think it's going to get better.
And get it taken care of. Again, I at least walked over here today. It was transit day today. I walked over here from the bus terminal, so I got a little in. I'll get a little more in this afternoon, but there is always room to do more. Dr. Mary Dombovi of Rochester Regional Health, thank you so much for being with us here on Connections. Our thanks also to our engineer, Vale, and to Caitlin Madison, who helped produce this hour. And a reminder, too, we've got Healthy Friday coming up, so much more health-related conversation here on Connections coming your way tomorrow. We will continue in the next hour talking about the Rochester Streetlight Festival and summer programs, too. Stay with us. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. This is Connections from member-supported public radio.